Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, together with my co-host, Loris Olson. Hello, Loris, and hello to you, the listener.
Hello, and it is good to be here.
Before we start, it should be noted that we are headed into what has been predicted, folks, to be an unseasonally warm week. It should stay in about the 40s during the day, all week, and on Wednesday, we're even predicted to experience a possible bright and sunny high of 50 degrees. Unusual weather for January. Speaking of January, Loris, last Thursday night, upon your recommendation, actually, I attended the State of the Community Report to Ames. It was held at City Hall. Accomplishments and challenges in 2014 for Ames were reviewed by civic leaders, along with some previews and predictions of what we can expect in 2015 and some possible challenges for the community. During the next hour, we will listen to some of the highlights of this update to the Ames residents.
Also, later in the hour, we will talk about two upcoming events. Tonight, the film Pay to Play, Democracy's High Stakes, will be shown at the Ames Public Library. This is about money and politics. Cornelia Flora will be joining us to discuss the issue with us so we can put the film into context. Also, we will hear from Clark Ford, who has produced a new musical. Yes, we have our own local resident producer of musicals. And Susan Franzen will interview him about 1961, the musical, Live It Up, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About the Bomb and Love My Wife.
Okay, let's get started. We are very happy to have with us Linda Merkin and Mary Sand from the Ames League of Women Voters. Thank you so much for joining us. Mary Sand is the League's publicity manager, and Linda is the outgoing president of the Ames League of Women Voters. Also, Linda, you moderated the State of the Community Report last Thursday night. Linda and Mary, if you would, please give us a brief rundown of what the League is and what its mission is.
The League of Women Voters is actually an organization that exists at three levels, local, state, and national. The purpose of the League is to encourage informed and active participation in government and to influence public policy through education and advocacy. And that's one of the reasons that we put on the State of the Community event in conjunction with our co-sponsors, the Chamber of Commerce and the Ames Public Library. The purpose of the event is really just to provide an opportunity for residents of Ames and Storey County to hear a concise summary of the operations of local government, what's gone on the last year, what the challenges are, and the plans for next year. Now, most of us are too busy to attend all these public meetings, and we think this is a way to just hear from the folks we elect on the progress they're achieving and the challenges they're tackling.
So it's kind of like greatest hits of the last year in government, in a way, a summary of that.
I like that title. Maybe we should change it. greatest hits.
Okay. Maybe you'll get 50 people next year instead of 25.
Actually, that's kind of interesting because we did change the title a few years ago. Historically, the event had been called Ames Happening, and we invited three entities, the mayor of Ames, the chair of the board of trustees of Mary Greeley Medical, and the president of the school board. In 2012, we changed it up quite a bit. First, we started to partner with the Chamber of Commerce and the Ames Public Library, and we renamed it the State of the Community. We also added the county supervisors as a presenter that year. And we held it in the library that year. In 2013, we had those four and held it in City Hall, or 2013. And in 2014, we added Iowa State University. And we continued with those five entities this year. And we really like the changes we've made. We think it really adds to the event in many ways.
Why did you decide to add Iowa State? Because to this point, they had all been elected officials.
Well, yes. A member asked about it. Basically said, well, Iowa State is, maybe it's not elected officials, but it is a huge part of this community. And when you, a lot of times when we talk about issues, Iowa State would come up. So wouldn't it be good to have Iowa State at the table as well? And I think just from particularly last Thursday's event, you just saw interconnectedness. There were all these people. And I think it was a very, very good
decision. Yeah, that was very evident, the interconnected quality. Why these particular representatives of these particular agencies?
Well, it's basically because what the League looks at is government. In a lot of ways. You know, we encourage voting. We encourage active participation in government. We encourage educated voters. I mean, that's why Carrie Chapman Catt started the League. She started it even before, a few months before women actually got the right to vote. But she basically said, if women are going to get the right to vote, we know it's going to happen. She had faith. And one state left to go, she had faith. And she said, we want women to be educated voters.
Mm-hmm.
And the League wants everybody to be educated voters. And this is just one part of how we can help that happen.
Now, who were the actual representatives from each of these entities?
Ann Campbell, the mayor of Ames, Luke Dierdorf, the Ames School Board, Sarah Buck of Mary Green Medical Center Board of Trustees, Rick Sanders, Board of Supervisors, and Miles Lackey from the Office of the President of Iowa State University.
Well, this is Local Talk, and at the onset of a new year, we're discussing the state of the community report to Ames residents held at the City Hall last Thursday. So let's listen to some of what was said during the evening. Since this is about Ames, let's hear first from the Ames mayor. She described 2015 as a pivotal year.
What we're going to see in the coming year is one of the most pivotal and challenging times that we've seen in the history of Ames. We've got a lot of big ticket items. We've got a lot of big challenges that the city is dealing with. One of them, probably that needs to be top of the list, is the city's land use. In 1997, through long, arduous work, developed and adopted a long-range, presumably 30-year, land use policy plan that was predicated on certain assumptions at that time about what the population of Ames would be, about how many Iowa State students we'd have, about the kind of housing that we would need and where it would be, about the amount of industrial space, even where the sewers were going was one of the very important aspects of. But it's certainly no secret that a lot of those basic truths are being tested right now. Nobody ever anticipated the skyrocketing Iowa State student enrollment or that SciRide would be carrying upwards of 7 million passengers annually, or that we would have the kind of affordable housing demands that we have, or that we'd have a Workiva come to town with 700 new employees with young professional interests in housing and amenities. Our water plant. We take for granted in Ames that we have some of the best water in the country, that we have both the quality and the quantity that we need. However, those days would run out without major investments. And so the major investment that is on the books now that we are going to see come to fruition in about the next 18 months is the $75 million new water treatment plant that'll have the ability to pump 15 million gallons daily. Another big ticket item is electricity. We are in the midst of converting from coal to natural gas. This, again, is a very big ticket item. It not only makes sense dollars-wise in terms of operating costs down the road, but environmentally, it certainly makes sense. We estimate that that will reduce our carbon footprint by about 312 tons annually. I don't know about you, I don't do well in tons of carbon dioxide. So translate that to 40%, and I can handle that better. Maybe you can too.
That was Mayor Campbell talking about 2015 as an especially important year for Ames. She gave the opening presentation at the State of the Community Report to Ames residents last week. And we have Mary Sand and Linda Merkin with us here from the Ames League of Women Voters. And Linda and Mary, the League also was very involved with issues of transportation in the past. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Before SciRide was developed, the League did a study and basically supported the development of public transportation within Ames, and we also have other positions on various transportation issues. So the League has been very involved in that. And one thing I thought was interesting, it's how much population is driving everything in Ames. And she references the land use policy plan, which wasn't good for 30 years. Now we've got it because of all the changes, development's gone different directions than the city thought it should go. Mm-hmm. And that's brought up a lot of issues. You pull in SciRide to that and look at, I just noticed the other day something that somebody said about high-density population areas are going to be on the outskirts of Ames. Mm-hmm. And because students may be going into those apartment buildings because of, you know, so many more students, that puts an additional pressure on SciRide because they have to go further to get all these students. I think that was really good news about the electric utility. You know, that was the thing I was personally concerned about when they were first talking about it. I think they have a plan now how they can continue to burn waste. I haven't really kept up on that. But, you know, a 40% reduction in carbon footprint, that's amazing.
It is impressive.
A lot of important issues came up, and they were discussed by the speakers, but there were also some issues that were raised by the audience as well. And a good feature of this annual State of the Community presentation is that time allowed for the audience to actually ask questions. For instance, questions were raised about safety and traffic flow on Mortensen Road.
Carolyn Klaus,
For the last 6 years, I have driven a granddaughter every Wednesday morning and sometimes other mornings from my home on Ashmore Drive down Mortensen to the Ames Middle School. I pray every time I go down Mortensen Road and then pull into the middle school and then pull back out. I know you put the light on the west side. Is there anything in the future to widen Mortensen from State to Dotson?
Extending Dotson from Mortensen to Lincoln Way should help with some of that congestion. So it'll be a direct access if you want to come in from the north to access the school. But I don't know about plans to extend Mortensen to four lane.
Mortensen is a challenging road in that it is a combination of several different jurisdictions, including the university. So I think that all three of us are looking at the traffic issues there.
I just don't want something bad to happen and then have to fix it because it was something bad happening.
Mm-hmm. So. I should note that it was just yesterday that I met with Hillary Kletcher, the president of our student body, as well as our senior vice president for business and finance, Mr. Warren Madden, and we actually discussed the transportation infrastructure at the university, an area which has to be looked at very, very closely, and there's going to have to be some mitigative actions made at some point with a number of the folks sitting at this table being in partnership to address that.
The voices you heard were Mayor Ann Campbell and also Ames School Board President Luke Dierdorf and Miles Lackey, Chief of Staff at Iowa State University for President Stephen Leith. We're discussing the State of the Community presentation that happened last week at City Hall, and Linda Merkin and Mary Sand from the League of Women Voters are with us today. The League of Women Voters hosted the event together with two sponsors, the Ames City Library and the Ames Chamber of Commerce. And today, as we listen to these snippets of the presentation given, we're looking at some of the issues that were brought up. Luke Dierdorf, president of the Ames School Board, reported in his presentation that enrollment in Ames public schools continues to drop and identified that as a challenge. Linda, as the moderator, you yourself asked a question from personal experience. I think you were speaking for a lot of people when you asked about how school district boundaries have an effect on the Ames public school enrollment. Let's listen to that.
You mentioned that the student population had been dropping. I happen to live in rural Gilbert, and I know that the student population of the Gilbert schools is exploding. And I look at more and more of Ames being in the Gilbert School District. And I know that some of Ames is also in the United School District, but it seems like the preponderance. There's a lot of Ames that's in the Gilbert School District now. And I wondered if there were any thoughts about whether that should be addressed and how so that does get addressed.
Sure. Let me just provide a little bit of information. So the line of demarcation between Gilbert and Ames is Bloomington. And it would take approval from the school board, Ames School Board, and the Gilbert School Board to change that line. And we've had those discussions with members of that community, and they're not interested. I guess the way I always present this to new parents looking to come into the district and build a house is you have options. We actually have more kids open enrolling into the district from the Gilbert School District area than going out. In addition, I know a lot of parents are wanting to come to Ames, but because of limitations in elementary buildings, they're not able to come in. So Fellows right now is pretty much full. With the finishing of that building, we'll have additional capacity to bring kids in. So that's why it was important for us to build capacity to try to attract additional open enrollees. Ames and Gilbert provide wonderful programs, and they're just different. So I try to tell people, make sure you do your research and understand exactly the type of structure you're looking for, and your kid will get a great education.
May I use some of Luke's time on that? Because I think this is one of the things in which the city land use policies overlap with the school interests. And as many of you know, when the original land use policy plan was established, the preferred growth area was to the southwest, much of which is in the Ames School District, and that was one of the primary reasons for including that. That is not the way it has worked out because of land availability and so on. So the pressure to move north and thus into the Gilbert School District has certainly been very, very intense. But it is one of the reasons I think that in every decision that we make as we look at what potential there is for additional housing within the Ames School District, we take very seriously.
That was Mayor Ann Campbell and Luke Dierdorf, the Ames School Board President, talking about school district boundaries at the State of the Community Report on Ames to Ames residents held on Thursday at City Hall.
And notice that land use came up for a second time. Linda, you said the League has studied land use policies in the past. It's very important, isn't it?
Yes, it is very important. And as the city redevelops the land use policy plan, I hope that we're able to follow that and be a part of that.
Yeah, this is the second time this is mentioned, that the original plan was for Ames to be developed towards the west, but because of lack of availability for properties, that the development has actually gone a different direction.
Right, and actually kind of to the southwest.
To
the west and Boone gets upset.
Southwest, okay. While dropping enrollment is a challenge for the district, Mr. Dierdorf certainly delivered good news about academic progress in the school district.
This partnership has forged a system which provides the highest level of education in the state and even the world. This claim can be substantiated by the results from the 2014 PISA test, which our students participated in this past year. PISA is an international test that compares educational performance across all countries. The Iowa governor invited 6 high-performing districts in the state based upon ACT scores to participate. 65 randomly selected 15-year-olds at Ames High volunteered to take the test. These students finished second behind Shanghai worldwide in areas of reading, math, and science. This is truly a crowning achievement. District educators should also be applauded for improvements in our students' achievement scores.
That was a recording of Luke Dierdorf, Ames School Board President, at the State of the Community Report to Ames residents. Start dates for public schools is a hot topic these days, and Mr. Dierdorf commented on this as well.
We are facing challenges. For the fiscal year 16 operational budget, as the governor and the state house representatives are proposing, only 1.25% increase in supplemental state aid, previously known as allowable growth, and 2.45% for fiscal year 17. This amount of educational support moves Iowa to the 35th in the nation on pure pupil spending for public education, which is previously a strength of our state and community. The district will be on budget guarantee at these levels due to decreases in enrollment and low supplemental state aid. Even with budget guarantee, we'll only have 1% more money in the current fiscal year. The proposed aid increases will not cover inflationary costs, let alone increases in negotiated salaries and benefits. The estimated impact will be between $0.5 and $0.75 million, potential program cuts leading to student programs in jeopardy, increased potential class sizes, and diminishing co-curricular activities. There are 2 additional challenges at the school district dealing with in the coming months. The first, as previously mentioned, is a declining enrollment trend. After a number of years of steady enrollment figures, our district's enrollment dropped 77 students this past year. This condition is somewhat perplexing, highlighted by the fact that from June 1st of this year, we saw 250 resident students leave the district with no clear explanation. Thus, the downward trend continues from when it started in the mid-1980s, when our enrollment was at 6,600 students, down to 4,300 today. Secondly, the governor's edict against early start for our public schools means we cannot start school until the week of September 1st. After switching to an early start this past year, our students were thrilled with the idea of ending the first semester prior to winter break. We started early for this reason and was supported by a survey of students and parents last year, which showed that 80% of 1,700 respondents were in favor. The earlier start date helps our students with advanced placement exams for college, in which we are administering over 1,700 AP tests last year. The early start is also more compatible with our district and Iowa State University, in which many of our students dual enroll. We are hopeful the legislature strikes the rule in favor of local control, which will allow communities like ours to make decisions for what is best for our district.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're your hosts today, Loris Olson and Ursula Rudenberg. Linda Merkin and Mary Sander here with us today from the Ames League of Women Voters, who hosted the event at City Hall last week.
That last clip we played from the event was of Luke Dierdorf, Ames School Board President. And, of course, he actually talked about 3 challenges: the budget, declining enrollment, and then the early start dates. No matter what start dates the Ames School District ends up with in the next few years, they will see even more changes for the school district properties.
The aging Ames Municipal Pool is well past its life cycle and need of replacement. We continue to be in discussions with our important partner, the City of Ames, concerning mutual use of a facility. The school's need is for a cold water competition lap pool, and we are looking for partnerships to help with the operational costs. Secondly, the district is finalizing design plans for the 24th Street development. The location will house a new district administration building, competition and practice baseball and softball fields, cross-country course, additional space for future development.
That growth will continue is certain, as Mr. Miles Lackey pointed out to Mr. Deardorff. Miles Lackey is the Associate Vice President and Chief of Staff to Iowa State University, President Leaf.
District isn't the only educational institution in Ames looking for physical changes. As you just mentioned about ISU, ISU is planning several facility changes also, but in this case, they are all due to student growth.
Some of you attending here tonight, as well as listening in and even sitting around this table, may have or noticed that we've had some enrollment growth, right? Just a tad bit. Fall of 2014 was our sixth year of record enrollment, 6 years in a row. Specifically, enrollment was over 34,700 students, which represented a 4.1% increase over fall of 2013. Much of that growth, in fact, almost 70% of that growth is attributable to, at least over the past 10 years, is attributable to just the colleges of agriculture and engineering. So when you really do look at some of the areas that we are known for as our core competencies at the institution, that is where we really are seeing a lot of our growth. We're more diverse than ever, too. I think that that's another very important point that folks need to realize. Over 23% of our students now are U.S. multicultural or international, and we're committed to being even more accessible, more inclusive, and more welcoming to anyone, regardless of their background. In the fall, Iowa State joined 10 public universities to form the University Innovation Alliance to identify ways to promote access and close achievement gaps. So we continue to try to build on this progress so that we can hopefully reach our full potential in this area. Also want to mention that we've also recently announced that we're going to be hiring a chief diversity officer to also further enhance our inclusive culture. And so while all these highlights are certainly certainly good. They also have their challenges as well as their opportunities. And so one of the things clearly as we've grown, we've need to staff up. We've been hiring more faculty and staff. Over the past year, we've hired over 100 tenured or tenure track faculty, including hires with expertise in key areas such as big data and translational health. And we're planning to hire actually an additional 130 tenured or tenure track faculty over the coming year.
I also heard an interesting comment after the presentation about the issue of diversity. A member of the audience commented that although Iowa State is hiring a diversity coordinator and really looking to facilitate that kind of transition in Ames in a more diverse population, that there was nothing of the similar type of initiative described on the Ames public school level, and that in fact a lot of the teachers and students at Iowa State who come in who are more diverse have children, and that this wasn't addressed, and there was a question and concern about that.
We are listening to some of the comments made by the State of the Community Report given last week at Ames City Hall. Now we're going to listen to comments from County Board of Supervisor Chair Rick Sanders talking about water quality and floodplain management.
We also continued strengthening our plans and policies regarding water quality and floodplain management. We were the grant recipient of $150,000 from the state of Iowa and played an integral role as a member of the Squaw Creek Watershed Management Authority. In December 2014, the Watershed Management Plan was approved with a mission to engage, educate, and encourage all citizens to improve the health stewardship resiliency of our watershed resources. Story County Conservation does a fantastic job, and our Environmental Health Department worked closely together with the Squaw Creek Watershed Management Authority. They were also recipients of state grant funding, and we're trying to address some water quality concerns in the Hickory Grove watershed, and we're going to do that by helping to replace all the septic systems in that area.
We're just listening to Story County Board of Supervisor Chair Rick Sanders. Linda, the league also has taken positions on the environment and water quality, correct?
Yes, and most notably, the League of Women Voters of Iowa, which is another level of our organization, has legislative priorities they adopt every year. One of them is specifically about water quality. It talks about the nutrient reduction strategy, additional funding for that, funding for REAP, and bottle bill. So we don't necessarily have a very specific policy about septic systems, but obviously that relates to water quality, so that was very good news to hear.
Next, we're going to turn to Sarah Buck, chairwoman of Mary Greeley Medical Center's Board of Directors. She pointed out the hospital's high ranking for quality and patient safety.
Healthcare consumers now have a great deal more information available to them than ever before to help them know how hospitals perform. Mary Greeley is performing extremely well by all measures. We have received a number of recognitions in the past year that I'd like to share with you. I want you to understand that the recognitions don't occur because we're seeking them, but because we're performing. They are a result, not the objective. So here are a few of the recognitions that Mary Greeley has received. Top performer recognition from the Joint Commission, which is a national hospital accreditation organization. For the second year in a row, one of Iowa's top 100 workplaces, as identified by the Des Moines Register. They received outstanding performance recognition by the Iowa Donor Network. They were named a most wired hospital by Hospitals and Health Networks. A little bit more about that in a moment. The hospital received an A rating from the LeapFrog Group for the fifth consecutive time. They received an Excellence in Patient Care Award from the Studer Group. And most recently, the Iowa Recognition for Performance Excellence Gold Award has been conferred by the Iowa Quality Center. The Iowa Recognition for Performance Excellence Gold Award is particularly significant. Achieving the Gold Award after the rigorous application and review process demonstrates that there is an organizational commitment to excellence at every level.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we are your hosts today, Loris Olson and Ursula Rudenberg. Mary Sand and Linda Merkin are also here with us from the Ames League of Women Voters, and the League hosted the event at City Hall last week, and Linda emceed the event. Mary and Linda, we'd like to give you the last word, your impressions of the event, any other issues that jumped out at you, and just give us a little wrap-up about the League and, you know, what is coming this year in the League. Give us the what's the League doing in 2015?
Well, a couple things that struck me during the evening, the recognitions that Mary Greeley has received for quality and patient safety. I work in healthcare myself, and I know that there is quite a bit of research out there showing that quality in healthcare and good outcomes are very much dependent on the entire clinical team being involved and communicating with each other and working together on each case. Another thing that very much struck me was because I had children in the Ames school system, and I have a granddaughter as well there. The declining enrollment and the low funding this year that's anticipated for the Ames schools, I'm very worried about the decrease in quality and programs in the Ames school system.
Linda?
I agree with everything that Mary said there. And again, to me, the thing that struck me so much was the interconnectedness. And there were times when we even had a speaker asking another speaker a question. Or when Ann said, can I talk a little bit more about what, you know, Luke just said, or whatever. It was just obvious that the folks at that table were really working together and how much they needed to work together, you know, to make this community continue to meet the challenges that it faces. The one I know that a lot of people are concerned about is affordable housing. And what I hear people say is, you know, we talk about affordable housing and we talk about affordable housing. When are we going to do something? You know, I hope that project on the north side of 6th Street that the mayor talked about, you know, I hope there's a developer that does say, I can do this. This works for me.
Okay. And that we didn't have time to run that particular clip. Basically, for people who've been here a while, you know, we're CPC preschool was, and they've moved, and the city has purchased all that land, and they're hoping to get some affordable housing in there.
Linda? I'd like to just give a little bit of information about the League, if I could, maybe take 30 seconds here.
Before you do that, I had one comment, too, about the interconnectedness. That, I felt, extended to the audience as well. As the person sitting in the audience, I felt that ample time was given for us to raise any issues with these elected officials and representatives. So that was kind of another aspect of the interconnectedness that I really did feel that night.
Okay. Well, I'm good. I'm glad to hear that because we think it's
so. Thank you.
We think it's important that people mm-hmm. get to ask those questions, and sometimes somebody will ask a question, and that will, you know, some kind of spark interest or spark another question. So mm-hmm. we believe that's an important.
Yes. Well, thank you
aspect.
Very much. It was a very, very nice event.
Great.
So tell us about the League.
Well, the League of Women Voters here, what I really wanted to talk about were some of the other events that we have coming up. We have general meetings that we do every month in February 19th, we have a meeting on primary health care, the new health care option here in Ames. And March 19th, we have a program on fair and affordable housing. So those are going to be coming up there in the Ames Public Library, 7 p.m. And we also have legislative wake-ups that we sponsor, and they are going to be the last Saturday of the month, January, February, and March. And they're in City Council chambers at 8:45 a.m. And all of this is on our website.
So give us the website.
Yes. www.ameslwv.org.
Repeat it.
www.ameslwv.org. And if you have any questions, you can always email president@ameslwv.org.
And thank you both of you for your service in the league. Appreciate it. And thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We are your hosts today, Loris Olson and Ursula Rudenberg. Ames resident Clark Ford is our very own producer of original musicals. He has a new production called 1961, the musical Live It Up, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About the Bomb and Love My Wife. Clark wrote and directs as well. KHOI reporter Susan Franzen spoke with him and filed this report.
My name is Clark Ford, and our current show is 1961, the musical, and it's going to be held on Friday and Saturday nights, January 30th and 31st at 7:30 p.m., and also Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. at Unity Church of Ames, 9th and Kellogg. This show is written, directed, and produced by me. It's not a church production.
There's a little story behind this production, I believe. This is not the first year with a musical behind it. In fact, it's maybe the fifth. Is that right?
That's right, Susan. I wrote a show, which I called 1972, the musical, and this was about 4 or 5 years ago. And then I wrote a sequel to that, which was set in 1983, and then a couple more sequels, each of them 11 years apart. And I really wanted to explore the backstory to 1972. So 1961 is a prequel to that first show that I wrote, which was set in 1972. And so we'll be looking at one of the main characters from 1972 and his wife. We'll be looking at his family in 1961. And it kind of explains where he was coming from.
Well, of course, these shows obviously are pictures of the time, pictures of the decades. So what was happening in 1961?
Well, 1961 was an exciting time, a time of economic expansion. It was a time of big music. The 50s had ended, but all of the changes that we may associate with the 60s had not really happened, except the election of 1960 when Kennedy was elected. So that had happened. But much of the culture, I think, was still basking in the glow of the 1950s.
Well, of course, 1960 with the Kennedys in the White House was Camelot, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. But underneath Camelot, there were still a lot of issues, obviously, that came to the fore later in the 1960s with the Cuban Missile Crisis and the civil rights movement. But all of those were issues that were the background to those issues was certainly alive, as was Sputnik and the Cold War. And so the Cold War plays certainly a part in this show. But one of the characters, the character that I portray, the antagonist, very conservative, patriarchal character, he has a bomb shelter in the backyard.
I remember when they had those. So I was just thinking the ages of the people who would see this. There are some of us who remember 1961, but I suppose not very many of the people who come here will remember it.
Yes, that's true. I was just in grade school in 1961, but, you know, my parents were not. And so this is kind of a tribute to my parents' generation. In fact, one of the songs, the title song, Live It Up, the lyrics come from some of my dad's favorite sayings. And so, you know, it's kind of a tribute to that hopeful, expansionist time in American history.
Well, I was trying to think of the music of that time because, of course, this is before the Beatles, but it was certainly after the time that Elvis Presley was popular, right?
Well, Elvis had started in the 50s, but he continued to be popular. There was the music is just wonderful. There's Frank Sinatra, and we have a song. In fact, Live It Up is kind of a Frank Sinatra song. There were musicals, Rodgers and Hammerstein. We have a Rodgers and Hammerstein kind of song. I've really tried to include a lot of different genres that were popular. Doo-wop, a little Motown, blues. There's some film noir, jazz. Peter Gunn was around at that time, and it was very popular to, you know, those kinds of detective shows, were cowboy shows.
So do you want to tell us anything about the plot?
Oh, yes. Well, in 1961, the musical, a lot of the show revolves around a woman who's 30 years old and still living at home. Her name is Irene, and she had a boyfriend in the early 1950s, but he did not return from Korea, and that was devastating. But now it's 1961, and she's kind of desperate to fall in love and get married. But she's living at home, and her father is very controlling, and her mother is very long-suffering. And she has a married brother and a sister-in-law who arrange for sort of a blind date to come for dinner. And it turns out, though, that this fellow is a Democrat, which does not please Irene's father. And so he gets heavily discouraged, which Irene is unhappy about. And the father thinks that he can find a better date for her. And so the next blind date that comes for dinner is a rancher who's a little bit older, and he's looking for a little lady to settle down with. And Irene is furious. And so she retaliates, and she invites a hot rodder to come just to sort of show her dad what's up. And her dad vows then that he will find her a Republican young man that she can fall in love with. And he does. And so the rest of the story is about that. Plus, there's other things that are going on all at the same time. There's six characters. There's three romances, really, and a lot of fun.
Well, do you suppose I could talk to some of the actors? Are they here for the rehearsal yet?
Yes, and I'll go find them.
Thank you. Here we are with one of the actors. Would you introduce your real self and your stage character?
I'm David Michael, and I'm playing the role of Robert, who is the middle love interest. We are a married couple that are fighting their way to become a more prosperous couple. So we're sort of slowly and gradually improving as the play goes along. We're one of the happier love stories going on in the show. He's a very factory-oriented, Republican, strong-minded individual, and he likes things his way.
Is he Irene's brother?
Yes, he's Irene's brother. He's Maureen's husband. So the major characters in the play would be the father and mother. Then I am the son with my sister. And then the other is Irene, my sister, and her love interest.
Love interests, I guess.
Love interests, yes, of course. She goes through several during the course of the play, partially her doing and partially her father's doing.
Do you take any part in those negotiations?
Not really. I'm more of a separate character from that. I do help line up one love interest, but that's about it.
Well, we'll have to come and see the play, I guess, to find out whether it's a successful one or not.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
So has it been fun to do this?
Oh, yes. I always enjoy doing these. This is about the fifth, I think, in the series of plays.
Have you been in all of them?
Yes, I have. I've cycled between being either Robert the father or in later plays, since they're every 10 years, I played my own son later on.
Thank you very much, Robert. And your real name?
David Michael.
And now we have the actress who plays opposite you to fill us in on 1961 from a woman's perspective. Would you introduce yourself and tell the character you're playing? And then we'll talk about some of the other plays in the series.
I'm Doris Nash, and I play Maureen O'Clark, the wife of Robert, in this show. I've played Maureen in all of Lark's shows, the whole series so far. And in the other plays, Robert and Maureen are the older generation. They're the mother and father heads of the family. And in this one, we see Robert's parents and have situations and occurrences in their lives. So it's a little different to play the same character younger than I've played her before, but it helps in seeing her journey, her life, and how things have changed and how she's matured and grown herself.
Now, I interviewed Robert earlier, David Michael.
He played Robert in the first show, 1972. Robert dies after that show. So by the time we get to 1983, Robert has passed away. So then David started playing the son, Bob.
So first he was your husband, and then he was your son.
Exactly.
Well, this must be a really fun series to have done.
Oh, yes, it is. It's good for me. I haven't been on stage in a long time. I used to do a lot of theater on stage. But once I started working for ISU Theater, I found I didn't have the time to be on stage as much.
Well, this didn't have a heavy rehearsal schedule, I gather.
No, it didn't. Since we're just doing a reading and not a staged show, you know, we get to carry our books, thank goodness, and don't have to memorize lines and things like that. We've had rehearsals mainly for the music, and today we're doing the blocking and staging.
Do you all sing your own songs?
Yes, we do. We all sing our songs. We have a small orchestra. There's different instrumentations for some of the songs. There's one piece that has cello. There are several that have violin. I think one or maybe more than one that have flute. Different combos.
Do you have anything else you'd like to say about your character or about this experience?
It's been a lot of fun. Maureen is, I identify with her actually quite a bit, even though she's older than I am. She would be about my mother's age, I think. And just seeing where she started in the 60s, the typical housewife.
While you were sleeping until 6, I dragged myself out of the bed at 5, throw on my robe and slippers in the dark. Then I start a pot of coffee, fix your breakfast and your lunch, kiss you goodbye and feed the dog so he won't bark. Then I wake the kids, make sure they're dressed, their hair is combed, their clothes are clean, they have their breakfast and are off to school. You would think I'd have a minute to myself, but no, your mom calls and she talks for half an hour about you. By the time she has hung up, I've eaten, done the dishes, and my nails taken all the curlers from my hair. Then I bathe and put on makeup, I get dressed to go out shopping, wearing clothes that look homemade, but I don't care. At the store, I watch my pennies, I know money doesn't grow on trees, I only shop where they get blue chip stamps. You might think I'm PMSing, but I'm really not BSing when I tell you that I've had horrific cramps. I stop, no, I pick up your dry clean suits and hurry home to start a load of laundry while I scrub the floor. Then I hang the laundry on the line and notice that my flowers need some weeding. It's just one more endless chore.
Thanks to Susan Franson, that was an interview with Clark Ford and about his new musical, 1961, and some of the people in the play. And we're going to cut out a little bit early because we have a guest here in the studio, Cornelia Flora. And the play that we just heard about will be performed at the Unity Church in Ames on January 30th and 31st at 7:30 p.m. and February 1st at 2 p.m. And many thanks to Susan for that interview and for Clark Ford. And our apologies for cutting out early, but we have one more guest we'd like to speak with.
Okay. And we return, obviously, to the present. And we're going to discuss tonight's local screening of a new documentary on money and politics. The film is Pay to Play, Democracy's High Stakes by John Wellington Ennis. And the screening starts at 7 p.m. at the Ames Public Library. A discussion will follow, and tickets are not required. Cornelia Flora, a distinguished professor emeritus at ISU and a member of the public interest group Public Citizen, is now joining us. Hello, Cornelia.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Would you tell us why you're bringing this film to Ames now?
We, as a group, are very concerned about the role of money in politics. As people are saying, show me in the Constitution where it says money, that the notion that $1, one vote was never meant to be part of our republic. And we're very concerned now, particularly with the ruling of the Supreme Court on Citizens United and the refusal of Congress to have these black money committees even tell where their money comes from about what's happening to American politics. And it's not just that politicians knows who gets them elected and is more likely to listen to them than to anybody else, which is a big part of it. But the other part of it is all this money has drawn us away from discussing issues in a civilized way to just accusation after accusation.
Okay. And I'd like to just point out that not everyone was displeased with the Citizens United decision. And I pulled a quote from the website for Citizens United, and I'd like to read that to you and then have you respond to it. Okay. This is from the lead attorney in the case. I think it may be the most important case in history because what that decision said is that individuals under the First Amendment cannot be inhibited, cannot be restrained, cannot be threatened, cannot be censored by the government when they wish to speak about elections in the political process. What is your comment?
Well, that is so interesting that he said individuals, because we don't know who those individuals are. Are corporations individuals? It doesn't seem to me that they have the same kinds of restrictions that I as an individual do have. It's very unusual the way he framed that, because basically what it says is any group, as long as it has the money, can say whatever it pleases, and you don't have to know who that group is, where that money came from, or why they are using it that way.
That's the essence of the Citizens United decision.
Yes, that here is, but the lawyers do say if Congress would require them to at least say who the contributors are, that would at least be a stopgap measure. But it's clear that we need to move toward a constitutional amendment where we make clear the difference between individuals and corporations. Corporations are extremely useful financial entity. I would not want to destroy corporations as part of our economy. But I'm a little concerned about them as dominating our polity.
Okay. One of the reviews that the producer has on the website for Pay to Play is a quote from the LA Times review. And it says, Play to Pay lays out a compelling case against corporate personhood and money as free speech. Researched, resourced, and interviewed, it was exhausted. Who are some of the key sources in this documentary that they use?
We have an amazing group of people who are featured in this, from Robert Reich, John Nichols, Lawrence Lessig, Noam Chomsky, and Jack Eberhoff, one of the major pay-to-play people who has been convicted for this. We have Jerry Springer. We have Brad Friedman, Marianne Williamson, a wide range of people who you've heard of. And for me, I'm particularly fond of the scholars. We have a lot of people who are reporters. We also have convicted felons who are speaking to this issue.
And when you say convicted felons, you are talking about people who were convicted of some type of money and politics violation, correct?
Exactly, okay. Exactly. So that we understand that these, and they sort of are able to basically describe their sins.
Okay. And I also did notice, as I was looking at the website, that there are four people who ran for political office, I believe at the congressional level, who were defeated, and the experts said that in part their defeat was due to the big money influence in politics. So it's quite a wide range of people who are in this film. You mentioned you said it's clear about the constitutional amendment, the need for that. But doesn't this movie give out some other solutions as part of the
there are a number of things that could be done. And I want to say that one of the problems of doing any of these things is, frankly, the people who really profit from pay to play are the media.
So I won't argue with that.
So unfortunately.
Can you explain that?
Okay, so we're paying to play. So what does that money go for? It goes for media consultants. It goes for buying primetime television. It goes for buying radio ads. It goes into buying ads on social media. So we have this huge self-interest on the part of our watchdogs to keep this in place.
And I think so, it's important to point out that they tend to be the corporate watchdogs, the large or what we call traditional media.
Correct. So play in this sense of how it's being used in this title means having a seat at the table, getting exposure, getting influence, right?
That's right.
That's the metaphor.
So it's very interesting to see when you go to Washington, do you get to see your congressional delegate or do you see one of their very able assistants? And my guess is the people who get to actually talk to the senator, the congressional representative, tend to be the people who have given a lot of money to their campaigns, whereas the rest of us are met with a charming young person who nods and says, oh, yes, that's absolutely right. Yes, we're very concerned about that. But the votes always go the other way.
Okay. And coming back to a couple of the solutions that were presented, because some of these solutions have been brought up in context other than just this movie. Mm-hmm. Public financing, full disclosure, you talked about a lot, okay? But one of them, end gerrymandering, for example. How does that affect the pay to play?
This is really interesting, and it's particularly interesting because Iowa is one of the states where we do not have gerrymandering.
And gerrymandering is?
Gerrymandering is this, that the lines of congressional seats are drawn, the congressional districts are drawn in ways that reassure that the incumbent or the party in charge of the legislature in that state at the 10-year redistricting time period make sure that those who have their seats retain their seats.
So it manipulates the distribution of votes within a state.
It manipulates the distribution of the boundary of votes. Mm-hmm. So that if you've got a lot of people who vote purple on one side and people who vote orange on the other, you just make sure that just those orange people are mushed together in either mushed together in one district and you lose that seat, or you put a few of them in all the purple districts.
Mm-hmm. So they have no influence.
And yeah. I just kind of bringing up the League of Women Voters again. The League of Women Voters of Iowa did a study, and this has been several decades ago, that actually was used as the basis for Iowa's law, which is a strict assignment by population base. Okay.
Yes.
The film is Play to Pay, Democracy's High Stakes by John Wellington Ennis. The screening starts at 7 p.m. at the Ames Public Library. A discussion will follow, and you don't need any advance tickets. So I'd also like to say for more information on it, you can go to www.paytoplay.tv.
That's Pay to Play TV. And thank you, Cornelia Flora, for coming in and giving us some context for this. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Loris Olson. Thank you for joining us and listening in as we will be posting this audio and various links associated with the organization on our website, khoifm.org. And also, remember that the play by Clark Ford will be at the Unity Church on January 30th and 31st at 7:30 p.m. and February 1st at 2 p.m. And we also heard today from Linda Merkin and Mary Sand, who are from the League of Women Voters, and they hosted the report to the community, the State of the Community, last week. And we appreciate you listening. And Loris, you want to end the show?
Okay. I want to remind you that our theme music is Backtracking by Elle Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. The show was engineered today by Richard Morrison. You can listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And also remember that KHOI is streaming on the web.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join us as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878. Please remember that your participation as audience is what makes us possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.
This is Jim Werbel reporting about the agenda for an upcoming Ames City Council meeting
on Tuesday, January 27th at 6:30 p.m. in the Ames City Hall. The meeting begins with a regular meeting of the Ames Conference Board. There will be a discussion of the city assessor's budget proposals, which include items such as changes in land evaluation and changes in tax rates. The regular meeting of the Ames City Council follows. There are numerous items on the consent agenda, such as liquor permits and capital expenditures. Of particular importance is the 2015 to 2020 Capital Improvements Plan. There's time for public input into this plan. There will also be a discussion of the city's branding efforts. The meeting will conclude with numerous hearings on moderate amounts of infrastructure expenditures. If you are interested in any of these issues, you can get more information on the City of Ames website.